From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is out today. I'm Barbara Bogave. The Tuskegee Airmen were the first African-American fighter pilots. They fought in World War II in a segregated army. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Bob Williams. He was one of the Tuskegee Airmen and is the co-producer of a new HBO movie about their experiences. Also today, we meet singer-guitarist Ira Kaplan and drummer Georgia Hubley. They're husband and wife, and they make up two-thirds of the trio Yo La Tengo. The band is a cult favorite and has just released its seventh album. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two works of lesbian fiction. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. U.S. human rights activist Harry Wu has been expelled from China following his conviction there on spy charges. Wu could have been sentenced to death. His expulsion could improve U.S. relations with China, Barry Schwein reports.
The Clinton administration, snubbed repeatedly by China, can now use the release of Harry Wu as an example of improving relations with Beijing. His quick release, after a 15-year spy sentence was imposed, also would make it easier for First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton to go to Beijing for a women's conference. She has wanted to attend all along and has the support of the State Department, but several senior members of Congress were pressuring the White House to have her stay home to protest China's record on human rights. A senior administration official, Undersecretary of State Peter Tarnoff, is in Beijing to try to get that record improved. Wu's release gets Tarnoff off to a positive start. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Zaire has stopped forcing refugees from Rwanda and Burundi back to their war-torn homelands. Thousands of refugees who had run away into the hills are beginning to emerge from hiding. A spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says the problem isn't over. Peter Kessler says Zaire's agreement solves only the immediate dilemma.
There is still going to be a refugee crisis in Central Africa. There are more than 2 million refugees in the region. It's a huge number, and they aren't going to disappear overnight. So there'll be continued needs for financial aid to care for these refugees, and more importantly, financial needs to support the countries of origin, like Burundi and Rwanda, so that they can absorb the vast numbers of people who have fled those lands in the last year.
Zairean officials have complained that the nearly 2 million refugees that it has have disrupted normal life in border areas, caused considerable environmental damage, and pose a major security risk. Zaire apparently feared also that any new eruption of warfare between ethnic Tutsis and Hutus from Rwanda would be fought on its land. The government says there's been another decline in orders for durable goods. The Commerce Department says the orders dropped 1.7% in July. Analysts say this suggests continued weakness in the economy. The government says the drop was due mostly to a 7.7% fall in transportation orders, which were mostly motor vehicles and parts. The woman who triggered the sexual misconduct trial of Congressman Mel Reynolds says she doesn't hate the Illinois Democrat. Beverly Hurd, who said Reynolds had an affair with her when she was 16, spoke to several morning television news programs. She says she has mixed feelings about Reynolds' conviction. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 4 points at 4,580. Trading is moderate. 292 million shares have changed hands. This is NPR. The Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has reached an out-of-court settlement in the overdose death of a Boston Globe health columnist who'd suffered from breast cancer. From member station WBUR in Boston, Mark Degan reports.
Terms of the settlement between the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the husband of the late Boston Globe columnist Betsy Lehman have not been disclosed. Lehman died in December after receiving overdoses of two drugs that were part of the chemotherapy treatment she was receiving for breast cancer. Lehman's death led to several investigations that resulted in new drug dosage safeguards at the prestigious cancer hospital. Lehman's husband has indicated he'll give some of the money he receives back to the hospital to create a breast cancer research fellowship in memory of his wife. Dana-Farber officials say they're now trying to negotiate a settlement with a second patient who also received overdoses at the institute but survived. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Degan in Boston.
The photographer who captured the famous VJ Day shot of a sailor kissing a nurse in New York's Times Square has died. Alfred Eisenstadt died late last night on Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. He was 96. Eisenstadt was working for Life magazine when he took the famous picture the day Japan surrendered in 1945. He photographed many well-known celebrities and political leaders, including Hitler shaking hands with Italian dictator Benito Mussolini in pre-World War II Europe. Hawaii is requiring some couples seeking a divorce to attend a class. Divorcing couples on the island of Oahu will have to attend a class if they have children between the ages of 6 and 18. The new program announced by the state judiciary is intended to make the change easier for children. A family court judge says similar programs on neighbor islands have shown benefits to families who are trying to get through the difficult transition. The kids' first program consists of a weekly session in a circuit court lounge. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. The 332nd Fighter Group was the first squadron of African-American fighter pilots in the United States Air Force. During World War II, they fought two enemies, the Germans and racial prejudice. These pilots, known as the Tuskegee Airmen, flew over 200 missions escorting heavy bombers into Germany. They never lost a plane to the enemy, and they shot down some 400 German aircraft. This Saturday, HBO premieres a feature film about the Tuskegee Airmen, starring Lawrence Fishburne, Andre Brower, and Malcolm Jamal Warner. Robert Williams is the co-executive producer and also co-wrote the screenplay. He was one of the Tuskegee Airmen. Williams grew up in a fairly well-integrated town in Iowa and was taught to fly a plane by his father. He tried to enlist soon after Pearl Harbor, but was turned away. When the Air Force decided to accept black pilot trainees, he took a train from his hometown to Tuskegee, Alabama. He told Terry that that trip was the first time he encountered raw racism.
When I got to Evansville, Indiana, that was the line of demarcation between sanity and insanity, better known as the Mason-Dixon line. Once you crossed that line, there was no more integrating of the races. So they forced me and every other black person who was on that integrated train to get off and get in the Jim Crow car, which was closer to the engine, and the smoke and soot from the engine would make the seats dirty and a very unpleasant ride. And so that was the Jim Crow car. And as I got off and the other blacks, we saw them usher in this contingent of German prisoners of war into the same car that we were forced to get out of. In other words, the enemy, our national enemy, was more welcome in that car and with others, more welcome than we were, and that was still quite a smack in the face.
What was the attitude of white officers in the training program at Tuskegee when you got there?
It all related to where they came from. If they were Southerners with bigoted attitudes, they displayed them openly. If they were Northern educated people, by and large, they were civil. That's not universal. There were some whites from the North who were just as bigoted as some from the South. But you could almost always count on the ones from the South as being very, very hostile.
There's a scene in the movie, The Tuskegee Airmen, where the Lawrence Fishburne character is flying a plane as part of his training, but he has to make an emergency landing, and he lands in a field in Alabama where, coincidentally, a chain gang, a prison chain gang, is at work. Did that happen to you?
It did.
Tell me about that, and tell me about the reaction of the men in the chain gang when they saw that you, an African-American, was the pilot of this Army plane.
I should mention that
these were African-American convicts in the chain gang.
That's true. That's very true. We were on a navigational, our final navigational exercise. These chain gang people had probably seen white pilots many, many times land and take off from that field. But as we landed, we removed our goggles and our oxygen mask, which revealed our brown faces. And as we taxied back to takeoff position, one of the young black fellows looked up and saw my black face And he screamed as though he had seen God. He said, "My God, these colored boys." And the others looked up and they screamed too. And it was the most heartrending thing I've ever experienced in my life. We had to wait a few moments before we took off to clear the tears from our eyes. It was so impactful. It was not unlike the feeling we all had about Joe Louis when he would win a fight. We hungered for heroes, and I guess we were heroes to those blacks on that chain gang. And it was the first time that we ever felt that what we were doing had some significance. We were just young kids who wanted to fly because it was glamorous and exciting and a safer place to be in the war. But when those people reacted in that manner, it was very, very revealing to us that somehow this was kind of special. But even so, we still never thought of it in a historical context. We didn't realize that we were making history.
The Tuskegee Airmen flew missions during the war, protecting American bombers. And you never lost a bomber. Were there ever white bombers who objected to having African-American escorts?
Oh, strenuously, initially. They succumbed to the stereotypical perception of who and what black people were, and they refused, I guess, to accept the fact that we were professional and courageous, just like anybody else, and maybe even more so. And they really resisted and really did not like the idea of blacks protecting them. I'll give you an example of how that happened, or a facet of what happened one day. I was leading the entire group. We normally fly 64 planes. It's four squadrons with 16 planes each, and if nobody aborts, has engine trouble, and has to go back to the base, we normally have 64 planes. So I had 63 planes strung out behind me, and I was on a collision course with a group of bombers that we were going up to protect. So I decided to go under them, and I switched to their channel to tell them that I was going under so that they would know what my decision was. And as I switched my channel, I heard somebody say, "Ooh-wee, look at them, jigaboos go." They knew that we were the all-black group because of the red tails on our P-51s. And I was so incensed that I pressed the button on my microphone and I said, "These jigaboos just may save your bigoted ass someday, you cracker bastard." I was so angry. Here we are up there offering our lives to protect them. They are talking about us in that manner. It was very, very insulting to us. Ultimately, however, they recognized very shortly that whenever we flew with them, they didn't lose any bombers. And so later, it didn't take much time for them to recognize that we were not only courageous, but we were also very professional. And they started to ask for us, "I think you better make that beg for us to fly cover for them," because they knew that we would not run off and look for victories and leave them to the mercies of the German fighters who would cut them to pieces.
Did you ever feel, well, you know, the heck with them? You know, I wish I could turn around and leave them to their own fate. I mean, what stops you from being so angry that you could, you know, barely function?
It was our job. Our commanding officer, Benjamin O. Davis, who endured 4 years of the silent treatment at West Point simply because he had the wrong paint job, if he could endure that kind of insanity, you know, a lesser man would have quit, and a lesser man than that might have committed suicide. He endured it, and he insisted that we stay with those bombers. His message was, those guys have to go through enough hell flying through the flak being the 88-millimeter shells that come up to your altitude and explode and throw shrapnel all over the place. And it knocks out people, knocks wings off bombers, and the shrapnel goes through planes and kills people. He said they have to go through enough hell flying through that flak over that target area. The least we can do is protect them going into that area and coming out of that area. And I will not tolerate anybody leaving the bombers. And we didn't. We never left them to the mercies of the German fighters.
Your commanding officer was Benjamin Davis, who was the first African-American graduate of West Point.
Modern day, yes.
Did he ever let on how much he'd been through when he was in West Point or thereafter? My impression is commanding officers don't share a whole lot about their personal reactions to things, but this seems like a pretty exceptional situation. How much did he tell you about what he'd been through?
He was very close-mouthed about it, at least to the most of us. And he never complained about it. He didn't complain about it while he was there, and he didn't complain about it after it happened. He had his eye on the prize, too, to graduate. He graduated in the top of his class and went on to become an outstanding general. He became the first three-star general in the history, black three-star general in the history of the military. His father before him was the first black general in the military. So he had something to live up to, and he did.
Terry Gross talking with Robert Williams. He was with the 332nd Fighter Group in World War II. He's co-produced a new HBO film about the Tuskegee Airmen. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Robert Williams.
Now, I believe you flew 50 missions.
Correct.
Shot down 2 German planes.
Correct.
And got a Distinguished Flying Cross.
Correct.
I'd like you to describe what it was like to be up in the air in one of those planes during World War II.
Well, I got to tell you, in viewing this film, I look at it today and shudder.
Yeah.
I said, I did that, my God, it's incredible. But at the time, you don't even think about it. I guess that's why the military wants young people. You don't have sense enough to be frightened, you know? I remember I was telling our director, our marvelous director, Bob Markowitz, I said, he asked me what was the most fearful time I ever experienced over there. And I told him that the most fearful time I can recall was sitting on the end of the runway one morning when there was a blizzard. The bombers went, so we had to go. We had to go provide top cover and protection for them. But as the plane in front of me took off, he'd get a quarter of a way down the runway and disappear in this snow. And I sat there wondering, how in the hell am I going to find him to fly formation with him? We're taking off toward the mountains. If I can't see him a quarter of the way down the runway, how in the world am I going to see anything else out there? And I said, if I come back and it's still snowing like this, where am I going to land? I knew I was going to die that day. And I sat at the end of that runway with tears running down my eyes. But I pushed the throttle forward and took off like the rest of the guys did. And, I'm sorry, but I'm breaking up a little here. A little emotional.
What saved you that day?
Well, you do what you're trained to do. The man says go, you go. And once we got a little altitude, we got past the snow, and the field was clear, and we were able to land. But nobody knew that when you took off. You just hope for the best. And that's, fortunately, the best turned out to be what happened.
What was it like to be up in a plane, being under fire, and being in a plane that, boy, by today's standards, are so technically unreliable? They seem primitive by today's standards. They seem like little motorcycles.
Well, that's true, but our competition was less of a quality machine than ours. We had the best there was in World War II, and we were very proud of the P-51 Mustang. It was a marvelous airplane. It's marvelous today, but by today's standards in terms of speed and firepower, it is kind of archaic. But in those days, it was the best. It was a state-of-the-art.
You had to wear an oxygen mask in order to breathe at the altitude.
Right.
You needed goggles.
Yes.
It was cold, I imagine.
In the winter, it's beastly cold. You lose, I think it is 2 degrees every 1,000 feet. So if it's zero when you leave the ground, or if it's, you know, let's say for practical purposes, it's zero when you leave the ground. Every 1,000 feet you gain in altitude, you lose two degrees of temperature. So if you get to 20,000 feet, it's 40 below zero. So, yes, it gets quite cold.
Were there times when you were in the air and had to watch as a friend of yours was shot down?
Oh, yes. I can't tell you how heartrending that is and how hopeless you are. You can't help him. You know he's hit and you know he's going to die. And if he's a close friend, it just tears your heart out. I've seen people who were in bombers that were a bullet or one of those heavy shells, 88-millimeter shells, would hit the wing of a bomber, for instance, and it would crumble like a wounded goose and tumble out of the sky like a wounded goose, cartwheeling and twisting in all kinds of manner. And you know full well that there's no way that anybody in that plane is going to get out because it's twisting so violently. And you know that everyone in there is going to die. I don't know how many people committed or comprised a crew, but you know whoever, however many there are, 10 or 5, 10, 12, whatever there is, they're all dead. And you just feel so helpless. You can't help those people at all. And that tears your heart out. And you don't even know them. So it's magnified many times when it is someone you knew and love.
When you got home from the war, did you feel that your accomplishments flying planes was recognized?
No, I don't. Recognized by the black press and the black public, but we still did not get any credit from the white press and from the military. However, ultimately, the President Harry Truman, bless his soul, when he signed the executive order integrating all of the military, he made the observation that he did so because of the outstanding and courageous work of the 332nd Fighter Group. Colin Powell, who is, was a top general in the military, made the observation that his promotion ascendancy to the status that he was in was accelerated by the outstanding work of the 332nd Fighter Group. The astronauts, the black astronauts, make that same observation many, many times. So now we are more or less getting the recognition that we thought we had earned years ago and was denied to us years ago.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I thank you for your interest in the project and in the picture, and thank you so much for your time.
Robert Williams is the co-producer of a new feature film about the Tuskegee Airmen. It premieres this Saturday on HBO. Los Fabulosos Cadillacs is a rock and roll band from Argentina. Music critic Milo Miles says the group is now making a push into the North American market with some help from famous friends.
If music is the universal language, some dialects are more universal than others. The last 40 years have shown that the lingua franca of pop music is rock and roll, and one proof is that the best of it from other countries speaks to fans here even if they don't understand the words. Recently, Mexican new wave bands have gotten some mainstream press attention and played some shows north of the border. But a 9-member band from Argentina called Los Fabulosos Cadillacs can stand and deliver with the best of their Latin peers. And they've been recording since 1985. About time we heard from them. This boost comes courtesy of a spanking greatest hits collection called Vasos Vacios and a new record, Rey Azucar, produced by Chris Rance and Tina Weymouth, the rhythm section of Talking Heads. The sound of Los Fabulosos Cadillacs can only be called rock and roll. Their name alone would tell you that's what they consider it. The band loves top 40 hooks and disco synthesizers, tough licks on electric guitar, and the adrenaline overload of punk. Especially on the retrospective Vasos Vacios, there's an innocent love of the rowdiness of rock, which is very distinct from the attitude of lesser groups who think just managing to play rock of any quality is liberating in itself. Still, Los Fabulosos Cadillacs rock is rich with components. These include horn sections out of soul music as well as waltzes, percussion from all over South America, accordion that echoes the tango, R&B saxophone breaks, and above all, the rubber bass and clipped cadence of reggae. Listen as veteran Jamaican DJ and rapper Big Youth adds trenchant interjections to this righteous workout.
Solo déjame saber quién sos. Solo déjame saber quién soy.
Every track on the Rey Azucar album catches attention with a ranting vocal break or a surprise serpentine arrangement. Hey, you have to be plenty confident and precise to have as much fun as the Cadillacs do singing a ska-like version of Strawberry Fields Forever with Debbie Harry. Only true rock and roll makes throwaways into such profoundly affectionate larks like this. It's absolutely fabulosos.
Milo Miles is a writer based in Cambridge. He reviewed two records by Los Fabulosos Cadillacs on Sony Discos. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Déjame llevarte hacia donde voy. Strawberry fields. Nada será. En nada lo que pensar. Strawberry fields forever.
Living is easy with eyes closed. Misunderstanding all you see.
It's getting hard to be someone when it all works out.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Melodic Chaos. We meet singer-guitarist Ira Kaplan and drummer Georgia Hubley of the trio Yo La Tengo. They've just released their 7th album. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews 2 works of lesbian fiction, The Intersection of Law and Desire, a new detective novel, and The Bebo Brinker Chronicles, a republished collection of lesbian pulp romances.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The U.S. Embassy in Beijing says Harry Wu is headed for San Francisco. The U.S. human rights activist was expelled from China hours after he was convicted of spying. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison and expulsion, but it wasn't clear at first if he'd have to serve the prison time before he was thrown out. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Madeleine Albright, told NPR that she's pleased Wu is coming home.
We're very glad that this development has taken place. It is very welcome, and it has been our highest priority to get Harry Wu out and coming home to America. So we're very glad that that has happened, and I think it does remove an obstacle in U.S. Sino relations.
There have been other thorny issues the United States and China have argued over. The U.S. has been distressed by Chinese offshore missile tests near Taiwan and evidence of Chinese missile sales to Pakistan. The top United Nations weapons inspector is returning to New York with new information about Iraq's biological weapons program. Rolf Akeas has learned Iraq had biological weapons during the Persian Gulf War. Baghdad had insisted the weapons were destroyed before the war started. But a UN spokesman now says they weren't destroyed until 5 months after the war ended. The first group of UN peacekeepers has pulled out of the UN-designated safe area of Gharajda. It's part of a new plan to protect the Muslim enclave with NATO airstrikes instead of UN troops. Richard Carruthers reports from Dubrovnik.
75 Ukrainian soldiers left Gharajda late Wednesday and crossed into Serbia. They were blocked for several days by surrounding Serbs, who wanted assurances they had not left weapons behind for the Bosnian army. The UN says the Ukrainians have lost 12 armored vehicles and all their rifles except one, claiming half were stolen by Serbs, half by Bosnians. 170 British peacekeepers remaining in Gharajda are also expected to pull out within weeks. The UN has not been able to persuade any countries to replace them, so just 12 military observers will be left in Gharajda. The UN has pledged to use NATO airstrikes if the Serbs attack, but the aid agency, Doctors Without Borders, has condemned the UN withdrawal, saying it will leave the enclave more vulnerable than ever. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Dubrovnik.
The Florida Peninsula is getting the remnants of what was Tropical Storm Jerry. The storm's been downgraded to a tropical depression, but more than 10 inches of rain have fallen in the last 24 hours in the Stewart, Fort Pierce, and Port St. Lucie counties. There's still a threat of tornadoes and severe thunderstorms over central Florida, and a flood warning is in effect for Fort Myers, which has been getting an inch of rain per hour. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow lost more than 4 points to close at 45.80. This is NPR. A Washington-based women's group has released a report on the difference in the way men and women vote, the so-called gender gap. The authors say while the gap is getting wider, the differences among other groups of voters, blacks and whites, for example, are much bigger. NPR's Laura Kanoy has details.
In the last congressional election, 53% of women voted Democratic compared to 42% of men. The National Women's Political Caucus defines that as a gender gap of 11%. Caucus Director Jody Newman says it's higher than in the past, but should not be blown out of proportion.
Commentators have tried to declare a war between the sexes ever since 1920, when women first won the right to vote. But the truth is that the way women and men vote is much more similar than different.
The authors found much bigger gaps when they broke down voter groups by other factors. There's the urban-rural gap of 29 points, with cities voting heavily Democratic, and the income gap, a 19-point difference between rich and poor. The biggest gap, 50 percentage points, was by race, with 92% of black Americans voting Democratic. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
Bond for the alleged killer in a high-profile Detroit death has been raised to $1 million. A magistrate says he bumped up the amount because of the severe beating of a victim before she fell to her death in the Detroit River. A witness says he saw suspect Martel Welch viciously hit and kick the woman as she sat in her car on the bridge. The witness says Welch shouted obscenities at her as he dragged her from her car, stripped her off her clothes, and rammed her head into the car several times. The attack ended only when she was jumping or forced to jump off the bridge. An aide to Russian President Boris Yeltsin says the leader chaired a government meeting today. Even though he hasn't been seen in public all week, he was last spotted in a hockey match on August 15th. There's been speculation about his health since he did not show up as expected to open an air show near Moscow. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Many people compare being in a rock band to being married. The members spend a lot of intense time together and feel a passionate personal commitment to the group. Yo La Tengo is just that kind of band, and it's also a real marriage between the founding members, drummer Georgia Hubley and guitarist Ira Kaplan. For the past few years, the band has been a threesome with the addition of bassist James McNew. Hubley and Kaplan started their musical union 10 years ago when they played house parties in Hoboken, New Jersey. Before they started the band, Ira Kaplan was a critic for New York Rocker, and Georgia Hubley was in art school. Her parents are the filmmakers and animators John and Faith Hubley. Yo La Tengo's new album, which is their seventh, is called Electro Pura. Terry Gross spoke with them shortly after they finished touring with the Lollapalooza Festival this summer. Before we get to the interview, let's listen to something off the new album. This is Pablo and Andrea.
Critic Howard Hampton, writing in the Village Voice, described one of your recordings as the softest, loud record he's ever heard. Georgia, how would you describe the sound of the band?
Well, I guess I don't know if I would ever. I try not to. But, you know, that is one of the things that the people who know the band know about us, that we like to do things that are really noisy and chaotic, and then also do very sweet, melodic type of songs. And somehow, both those things seem to define the band.
Do you find that your listeners gravitate to one side of the band or another, that some listeners like the noise aspect and other listeners like the more acoustic or at least, you know, quieter sound? And do you have concerts where you just do one or the other?
I think the people who, like Georgia says, who like us best, at least, appreciate the way we can go back and forth. Just, we do acoustic shows sometimes, usually at, like, record stores or radio stations, and sometimes we also do just pretty much all-out noise shows, but we usually bill that under a different name at this point, just to kind of warn people that there really won't be anything song-related.
What name?
Sleeping Pill.
Uh-huh. How'd you come up with that?
Well, it was a song title. We had this long jamming song that we were playing live a few times, and we would open our shows with it, kind of just to sort of set a mood. And then we were doing this show in some city in Holland, I don't remember which one, and we had a really rotten time playing, and we finished our set, and for some reason people who had been completely unresponsive the whole time we played clapped sufficiently that we felt compelled to play an encore, although we weren't really exactly in the mood. So we went on, and for the only time, I think, ever in the doing this song, which didn't have a name at the time, we decided to do this long slow jam, which I think very effectively said to people how we felt about the show. I mean, it's really fun to play, but it certainly was at that moment in a concert was pretty directly antagonistic. And the punchline is at the end of the show, some Dutch person came up to us and sort of sneered at us that your music is like a sleeping pill to me. So I said, thanks. I guess we got a name for the song.
Well, it sounds like it was Dieter from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, well, I am a master of accents. So.
Yeah, there's one of those in every country.
You formed the band when you met in 1985. What were you doing, each of you, before forming the band?
I wasn't really doing much. I think I was going to art school, probably, or just on my way out of art school. I went to a school where you could really just not go for weeks on end. I think one day it dawned on me I wasn't actually going anymore, and then officially abandoned the whole thing.
And Ira, you'd been working as a music critic.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Ira, is it hard for you to start performing after being a critic? I mean, critics can almost get bored easily because they've seen so much, you know?
Well, it was hard for me to start performing for the same reasons that I didn't have a band. I mean, for whatever reasons, I always found it difficult to accomplish that. I think I wanted it so much that it just seemed unobtainable until really I met Georgia and there were kind of two of us in it together.
You must have found something in each other that made you comfortable about playing, considering you hadn't really been in bands, or at least not in performing bands before. Am I wrong? I mean, did you feel more comfortable playing around each other than you had with other people?
Oh, yeah, well, definitely. I mean, for a long time, we would just play together without anyone around. And, it did take us a long time to play in front of people. That was a big step. You know, every step was kind of a big step.
What is it that you found in each other that you hadn't found with other people that you tried to play with?
I'm not sure. I don't think we've ever thought too hard about it. But I think we were just similar enough in that we both enjoyed playing, didn't care that we didn't play especially well, didn't care if the other person, you know, the feeling we were getting from playing mattered more than what we were accomplishing, and I don't think we were very judgmental of each other, certainly when we started. Now we're ruthlessly judgmental.
That's Ira Kaplan and Georgia Hubley of Yo La Tengo. They'll be back in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry Gross's interview with the band Yo La Tengo.
You have a CD I quite like called Fake Book, which is an album of some originals, but mostly of covers of mostly, to my mind anyways, obscure songs. Why did you decide to do a CD of covers?
We had been doing, as I've said before, these acoustic performances we would do at radio stations and things, and because they were informal settings, we tended to learn a lot of cover songs to play at them, and we ended up just with this separate repertoire of acoustic songs. At the time, Georgia almost never sang when we played our rock songs, but she sang all the time on the acoustic ones, and it just became this almost parallel band that we had gotten, you know, some attachment to.
Well, I want to play one of the covers. I think I'll play Here Comes My Baby, which was a hit, what, in the late 60s, was it? Mid-60s? I don't remember the date.
Yeah. You didn't get to see Georgia grimace when you said that.
What? Grimace why? Well, you don't like the record?
Oh, no, I like the record. That's maybe not my favorite song.
Well, I'm going to force it on you.
It's just, fine. I'm not hearing it, so.
Okay, the original hit was by the Tremolos, and I didn't realize till reading your liner notes that it was actually composed by the Dread Cat Stevens.
Yeah, I won a bet on that in a record store one day.
What, you said it was composed by him and someone refused to believe
it? Yeah.
How did you know?
I'm one of these people who always read liner notes and songwriting credits and like to laugh at the jokes and the publishing company names, look at the messages on the inner groove. I was a very thorough record listener.
Now, Georgia, do you not like the song or do you not like the original? Do you not like your cover? What's the problem here?
Brother. It's just, I guess it's, I mean, the whole record has a certain sound to it that I do like, and certain songs just seem a little kind of peppy and just not my favorite kind of song, basically. And there are a lot of songs that I really love on that record that have just expressed more to me than that one.
Well, excuse me for choosing something peppy.
Well, you asked me.
All right. Now, my alternate to play was The One to Cry, your cover of the old Escorts recording.
Right.
Would you have preferred that?
You know, in a way, I like that one better, and I know they're not really that different.
That's peppy, too.
I know.
But it's funny, that one...
Somehow
it's
different for me.
It's funny, both of those songs are definitely songs that are more in my taste than George's. I tend to go for the kind of sappier pop song than Georgia does, I think. Especially the early 60s... sound.
Mm-hmm. Is this because you're a few years older than she is? I mean, you're not much
older.
No,
I think I'm just a bigger sap.
Right. Well, there you go. What, should we play The One to Cry now?
Okay.
What the heck?
Oh, I can't bear to be the one to keep you from my side. How could you be so cruel? You played me for a fool. But if I change my mind, then I will throw away my pride. So now what should I do? Oh, how I wish I knew. Oh, if I say goodbye, then I am gonna be the one to cry. Cry, 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 cry. Cry, 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 cry.
Georgia, I know that your parents are animators and filmmakers.
Yeah.
And that your father was a co-creator, I believe, of Mr. Magoo, the cartoon character with the voice of Jim Backus?
Uh-huh. That's true. It's actually a pretty long story, but he used to work for Walt Disney, and then he left Walt Disney and formed this other company called UPA with other people, and that's where Mr. Magoo came from, and I think that was one of the original characters. And then he left UPA, and then he met my mom, and they started making their own films, which are not commercial films. They're well known in a certain sense because there's not a lot of that kind of animation. Is certainly not in the early 60s, late 50s, and they made some really, really amazing animated films. But my dad died in the late 70s, and my mom continues to make animated films. And
so does her sister.
And my sister does too, yeah. And I've worked on, actually, my sister and I worked on a lot of my mom's films, and then my sister started making her own films, and I worked on her films, and blah, 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 blah.
Doing artwork or voices?
Artwork.
Huh. Now, the first time I heard the band's name, Yola Tango, I thought, they play world music.
Yeah, you know, we weren't really thinking about that. We picked the name to not connote anything. I guess we're so myopic. We're just myopic, whatever it is we were. We were thinking only in terms of rock bands. We thought as a rock band name, it would be very nondescript. And I think we forgot that there were other genres of music out there that it might be connoting.
So what does it mean?
I guess it means I've got it. We don't even speak Spanish. It was just something I saw in a book.
And that appealed to you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think there was also that element of we had an upcoming show and we needed a name like within 24 hours. Little did we know, you know, 10 years later, you still have that name. But
are you ever surprised by the talent that you have since you spent a long time not playing in a band? And now, I mean, you know, you play, you sing, you write songs. I mean, did you know you had that in you?
I just find it impossible to, this isn't one of your Joni Mitchell interviews. I find it impossible to answer questions about my talent.
Your great gift?
Yeah.
Tell us about your unique special gift.
When did you know you had
this? I always knew I wanted to do it, and I always knew that in a certain sense, you know, I could do it, but that doesn't quite translate, I think, to the question you asked.
Okay. Georgia, anything to add about your unique special gift?
I do not think so.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Terry Gross spoke with Georgia Hubley and Ira Kaplan of Yo La Tengo. The band is currently touring in Europe and will start a U.S. tour in October. Off their new album, Electro Pura, this is Tom Courtney.
Julie Christie, the rumors are true. Last pages turn, the eyes are blue.
This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel of NPR's All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll be hearing about the announcement from China that human rights activist Harry Wu has now been expelled from that country. We'll also be talking with Dr. Marty Feshbach, an expert on health in Russia, about that country's declining life expectancy and rising mortality rates. Also, a talk with Richard Rhodes, author of a new book about the making of the hydrogen bomb, and a report from Orange County, California, on progress that county, which witnessed one of the nation's largest bankruptcies. Those stories all coming up today on All Things Considered, next from National Public Radio.
Summer is quickly drawing to a close, so book critic Maureen Corrigan wants to make two final recommendations for good beach reading. Whether you take her up on these recommendations might depend on what beach you go to.
Lots of people said it couldn't be done, that it simply wasn't possible to create a hard-boiled, feminist, lesbian detective. I've got to admit that up until a few weeks ago, I agreed with them. The fictional dyke dicks I've encountered have talked tough, but they've seemed squeamish about participating in the genre's masculinist glorification of violence. Like many of their straight sisters in crime, lesbian detectives, when put to the test, chose to symbolically surrender their PI licenses and hang on to their feminist credentials. Mickey Knight, however, is one gay gal gumshoe who manages to dodge the bullet. In her debut outing, ponderously entitled The Intersection of Law and Desire, Mickey spends as much time interrogating received assumptions about sexuality as she does interrogating lowlifes. For instance, Mickey uses firepower to exterminate a boatload of sadists. Meanwhile, her cousin Torben, another one of the lavender sheep in her family, minces about in high heels. So who's more manly, more womanly? Long after all other mysteries have been cleared up here, the central mystery of self-identity refuses to yield easy solutions. The first two-thirds of this novel are driven by the force of Mickey's tortured personality and the vividness of her milieu. J.M. Redman depicts a different New Orleans from that of John Kennedy Toole or James Lee Burke. Mickey's City is a queer metropolis, a sinkhole of secrets and scandal. Towards the end of the book, raw social observation gives way to brutal whirlwind action as Mickey single-handedly rescues her lover and a group of children from a voyage of the damned. As her name suggests, Mickey is a contradictory creation, a feminist lesbian offshoot of both Mickey Spillane's fascist detective Mike Hammer and Raymond Chandler's urban knight Philip Marlowe. But in the intersection of law and desire, she proves she's nobody's girl but her own. To appreciate how extraordinary Mickey's transgressive behavior is, you should pick up the new quality paperbacks edition of the Bebo Brinker Chronicles by Anne Bannon. Bannon first published these entertaining lesbian pulp romances in the 50s and early 60s, and they read like what the many loves of Dobie Gillis would have been like if only Zelda had been able to confess her secret desire. Odd Girl Out, the first novel in this collection, describes the sapphic awakening of a sorority girl named Laura. The next three novels describe her life in Greenwich Village with her sometime lover, Bebo Brinker, a jaunty girl who works as an elevator operator so that she can wear pants all day. Bannon created her romances out of the overheated purple prose of pulp. But like all popular literary forms, their unsophisticated style makes the assumptions and prejudices of the culture more explicit. Terrified by her yearnings for her roommate, Laura desperately assures herself that homosexual women were great, strong creatures in slacks with brush cuts and deep voices. "I don't want to be a boy," she cries. "What's wrong with me?" As you can see, Bannon's romances don't offer a wholehearted affirmation of the gay life. This is the Freudian 50s, after all, when homosexuality was equated with arrested development. The most upbeat ending here occurs in the novel entitled Women in Shadows, where lesbian Laura marries a gay man and they live happily ever after in the closet. As Bebo and her pals demonstrate, those fabulous 50s family values that are invoked so nostalgically today made an awful lot of people feel like freaks.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Intersection of Law and Desire by J.M. Redman and The Bebo Brinker Chronicles by Anne Bannon. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction by Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.